folks, and welcome to this week's episode of the podcast. I'm happy you're here. Today's guest is a returning guest. You may remember he was here a while back talking about his excellent bio of Burt Burns. Today he's got a book, Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise. His name is Joel Selvin, and I'll tell you, next time he's in New York, got to get him with a big pile of records to come in the studio and just talk music and goof off, because this guy's talked to a million people, interviewed a lot of interesting folks, and done a lot of interesting work. I would check out joelselvin.com for information about all of his stuff and lots of archives and stuff like that. Super interesting guy, nice guy, knowledgeable guy, sense of humor, you know, the complete package. What can I tell you? Enjoy talking to him. So here it is, me and Joel Selvin talking about Hollywood Eden. You can, of course, check out wfmu.org/Michael for the archive of my previous talk with Joel or other guests who will compliment this one. They're all there in the archives waiting for you. That's it. Hope you're well, safe, sane, etc. Hope you got your shot or are scheduled to get it. That's it. Talk to you soon. Okay, there is Jan and Dean, and I think Joel Selvin is on the telephone. He is the author of Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise. Hi, Joel. Welcome back.
I am on the phone. Hi, Michael. Good to see you, or talk to you.
Good to hear you. You folks may remember you were here in May 2014 talking about your amazing book that everybody loves, the Burt Burns bio called Here Comes the Night. And you've been a journalist for eternity, and I would invite folks to go to joelselvin.com rather than hear me read your resume on the radio. It's really an amazing body of work. I love the new book, but as I've been telling folks...
Thank you.
You're welcome. As I've been telling folks about it, it is sort of hard to summarize in a nutshell exactly what the book is about, because it's not about one character or one band or something. So how do you explain this book to people?
Different ways time. Starts in with the high school class at University High in 1958, and it follows a group of people who graduated that year through their next 8 years of their lives as they kind of invent rock and roll in Los Angeles and create the whole West Coast pop sound. It goes from Jan Berry and Dean Torrance singing in the shower after football practice with the rest of the guys on the team to Brian Wilson making Good Vibrations. How's that?
That's pretty good. I'd say you've done well. You mentioned that the University High School, Jan and Dean, Nancy Sinatra, Kim Fowley, Jill Gibson, Sandy Nelson, Arnie Ginsberg,
Bruce Johnston.
Bruce Johnson, all these people. It's a mind-blowing thing. You know, there's really no central, like I said, there's no central starring figure of the book, but I would say the closest thing would be Jan Berry of Jan and Dean. And he comes off as this sort of very interesting character. He's a rich kid, but also a certified juvenile delinquent, but also an A student who gets A's without ever studying. Was that by design, or did he just emerge in the course of the research and the writing as the natural kind of lead character?
Well, Jan Berry is kind of the propulsive engine of this narrative, and in many ways, it mirrors what he did in his life. He started L.A. pop music. I mean, there are other examples of it that precede him. You know, Ricky Nelson, for instance. But that was like an offshoot of a TV show, and Hollywood always knew what to do with offshoots of movies and TV shows. Jan recorded his first top 10 hit for several top 10, for several hits, in his family garage on two tape recorders that his father borrowed from his boss, Howard Hughes. So, I mean, that's like the very seed of this whole thing. And his records were enormously influential in Los Angeles, even if they weren't like top 10 hits after Baby Talk for a while. But they were always on Los Angeles radio. And when the Beach Boys came out in 1962 with Surfin', I mean, that people instantly recognized that that was a cop of the Jan and Dean style, sort of a riff on Baby Talk. So Jan Barry was really the seed of all this that would sprout in just a very few short years.
One of the interesting things is that the book paints this picture of L.A. as this small town where people like Jan Barry could just literally go knock on the door of a famous person or a record company. And there's multiple examples of this happening many times. And it's so different from how things work now.
Oh, it was. Hollywood was a small town. That fascinates me. The idea that the intersection of Sunset and Sepulveda was a four-way stop sign with crops growing on each corner and a little vegetable stand where the farmer sold his goods. I mean, that just boggles my mind. And University High in 1958, these are kids from Brentwood and Bel Air. These are some of the most privileged show business families in Los Angeles, feeding into a public high school. They drive themselves to school. They're 10 minutes from the beach. Say, let's go play volleyball after school today. I mean, to me, this was kind of a perfect time to be at perfect time in a perfect place to be an American teen.
Yeah, it truly was. And it kind of, you know, reading the book, and maybe this is too big of a question to answer, but was the personality of Jan or all these kids, was that a product of their, you know, particular place in time and history in their Southern California location? Or, you know, and having parents that were the Greatest Generation, and did that, you know, is that what it was that made them fearless and think that they could just go knock on doors and reinvent the music industry? You know, was it a product of their specific upbringing?
Well, you're so right, Michael. I mean, it really was the kind of fearlessness born of privilege and innocence. And the story of Hollywood Eden from the football locker room shower sessions to Dead Man's Curve and beyond. I mean, that's a path of from complete innocence to self-knowledge. And that's a classic hero's journey right out of any kind of literature. And as we all know, that pathway can often be treacherous.
Yeah. One of the things that rang a bell for me was that these kids had so much less cultural influence possibilities than kids today have. And so, you know, that whole list of kids all heard the same records more or less, all watched the same TV shows. And so they, when they went to kind of forge the next link in the chain, they all had the same direction. You know, they were all headed in the same direction. That makes sense?
Yeah, well, it was a movement. There's no question. The class of 58 entered high school in September 1955, almost at the exact time that Bill Haley and the Comets hit the charts with Rock Around the Clock and James Dean died in that car crash. I mean, they were the rock and roll high school class. Elvis was their sophomore year. Buddy Holly and Everly Brothers were their junior year. And they were their own senior year. I mean, Jan Barry's first top 10 hit was when he was a senior in high school.
Yeah, the book starts in the 1950s, which you don't, at least I didn't, assume that the link was quite so far back. I mean, in junior high school, Bruce Johnson is in Jan Barry's garage, if I remember right. But what the thing that, yeah, that really blew my mind about this record was this was a time when major labels, or I guess the record industry as a whole, the recording industry, was not making product for young people. It was an industry for old people who bought, you know, turntables and sat in their living room and listened to Mitch Miller or whatever. And the book tells the story really well of how these kids, literally these kids, transformed that. And there's multiple instances, this is what I love, of, you know, small labels or big labels that had old people that were like, run out and get me a teenager because I don't know what this is, but I need to get some of this into my record company right now.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what's happening, but, you know, find me a kid who does.
Right.
Yeah, that was going on. The major labels lost control of the hit parade in the second half of the 50s. And the big companies that were invariably run out of New York, like RCA Victor and Columbia and Decca, had no roots in what was a grassroots phenomenon, this rock and roll thing that flared up out of the South and the ghettos of the North. So the independent labels actually encroached on the major label market. I mean, by the end of the 50s, the Atlantics and the Chess Records and the labels that had been catering to small elements of the society, mostly blacks or Latinos, were carving out the lion to the majority of the hits on the chart. It was crazy. And the majors only sort of like, you know, clawed back that share in the last half of the 60s and in the 70s. Independent labels were where rock and roll was born. And it was because these were independent, sort of visionary type guys who were on the margins of the business and saw the youth market as a place to operate. And they had to deal with this brand new art movement with all these excited and enthusiastic musicians who were creating this fabulous new music.
There's so many great stories in the book about what we said before, someone knocking on a door, somebody saying, well, I'll give you $50 for this, releasing it a week later. You know, maybe it flops, maybe it becomes a hit. You know, maybe and there was a much more fluid thing in the record business with just, you know, one song at a time. It was, you know, there was no plan sort of longer than that.
Oh, the Beach Boys were like the first American rock group to have a so-called career. Up until that, you were expected to get a hit record out of them and then maybe something that, called a follow-up that might do almost as well, but the third record was out of the question. So that whole thing was just not a part of being in the record business. You know, the Beach Boys changed that. The whole Los Angeles scene changed so much about how music was going to be presented, what kind of music, how records were made, all that stuff between 63 and 67, that was where the revolutions in the recording industry were going on. And it started out with Los Angeles being this very remote, minor part of the music business, where which was dominated monolithically by New York.
It's just one of the sort of many stories in this book. Joel Seven's book is called Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise. Let's get back to Jan Barry for a second. He, like we said, unusual guy. And like a lot of characters in this book, he's desperately trying to avoid being drafted for the whole book. But yet he produced some very right-wing sort of patriotic-themed records. What was that about?
Those right-wing records were like in the last year of his career. He was losing touch with the sort of pop zeitgeist and drifting away from the consensus. He had had a great run at the front of the crowd where his records were the brightest and the most advanced productions and using the best musicians, but he was beginning to sort of lose touch with that thing because right at the time he's putting out the Universal Coward and these right-wing tracks, the whole record market is swinging left and embracing the anti-war peace movement and turning in towards the hippie thing. So he was swimming upstream on that, but you know, I think he was probably a Republican sort. Dean Torrance, you know, certainly is. He's singing with Mike Love New Year's Eve at the Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
Politics wasn't really a part of rock and roll until like in the mid-60s. Rock and roll was politics. It was personal politics.
It's interesting, though, that the many guys who tried to avoid the draft were, looked at themselves as patriotic people. I think that's an odd situation. So let's talk about writing the book. How many folks did you talk to? How long did it take to put together?
You know, you never can really answer that question exactly because I've collected a lot of this over many, many years. One of the great sources for this book was my friend Steve Douglas, the saxophone player who really contracted the first Wrecking Crew session for He's a Rebel. And Steve died in 94, but we'd spent dozens and dozens of hours talking about this stuff and drawing from him a lot of the things that were very vital to the book. The process itself, once you know I got publisher agreeing to do this and filling in the research I wanted to fill in and finish the book, under a year. But really, you know, I've been working on it since 2014, right after the Burt Burns book. is when I met with Jill Gibson and got her to agree to participate so that, you know, I had felt like I could bring something new to the subject that I really wanted to have in my pocket before I moved forward. So, I mean, this has been a many-year project in many ways.
Yeah, Jill is an interesting character. She is she right? Am I right? She's Dean's girlfriend, and she made a couple of interesting solo records and kind of was a model and then ended up very briefly joining the Mamas and the Papas. And she's a photographer.
Jan's girlfriend, actually, not Jan's Dean's. Girlfriend. And one of the real issues for me in taking on this story was it was such a boys' club. How do you portray what the role of women were? And how do you bring women out of the background? And Jill Gibson, who is invariably described as Jan Barry's girlfriend, was anything but somebody's girlfriend. With her cooperation, and she's been reluctant to talk about this stuff because it's just her youth. I mean, shortly after all this stuff, she left Los Angeles, went to New York and Italy and studied to become an artist. And she's a widely exhibited painter and sculptor. I mean, this is just some crazy aberrant youth that she had. And she doesn't spend a lot of time looking back. So that was a real important linchpin to thinking that I could do the book, that I could have this female story in the foreground. I brought Nancy Sinatra out of the background. I do not understand how Nancy Sinatra could have such significance as a recording artist, make such important records, and have her story be so ignored by rock historians. I suspect it has something to do with that rock historians are mostly males. But really, this is the first major account of Nancy Sinatra's career and background that I know of. And that just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Also, I should point out that Barry Keenan, who was Frank Sinatra Jr.'s kidnapper, was also a university high guy. So there's a lot of layers, too. And all of this is in the book, I should point out.
Gidget, too.
Yeah, right. Gidget, who is in some ways, you know, one of the first mass distributions of this idea of this idyllic baby boom teenager lifestyle in California. It kind of starts that myth going. The book Gidget.
So true, the movie, Michael. Yeah. The Gidget book, the novel that the movies were based on, which was written by her father. Her name was Kathy Koner, and they called her Gidget at the Beach. And that book was on the bestseller list the same time On the Road was. I wonder which book really had more impact in sort of shaping California and the national imagination, you know?
That's funny. Well, as you said earlier, the book kind of goes from baby talk to good vibrations, and it's an incredible 8-year period just in, you know, for American history. And I always say that, like, music history is American history, and it's such a great lens to look through the cultural, social changes, you know, of the country, and that's, you know, an amazing time. So I want to remind folks again, Joel Selvin's book is Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise. Thanks for joining us this morning, Joel.
Great, Michael. Good to be back.
Tell me, do you have a Jan and Dean song that we started with, a Jan and Dean song? Do you have another one you want to hear?
Well, you know, there's so many great ones, but of course, you know, Jan Barry's life is wrapped up in Dead Man's Curve.
Okay, perfect. Let's go out with Dead Man's Curve. Let me cue that up. Perfect. Thanks, Joel, and be safe.
Thanks, Michael.
Should have heard the whine from a screaming machine. last thing I remember, Doc, I started to swerve, and then I saw the Jag slide into the curve. I know I'll never forget that horrible sight. I guess I found out for myself that everyone was right.
Welcome back from dinner.